Please call the case.
Case number SCW-12-266, Helberg versus Wynn. Arguing for the petitioner, Laureen L. Martin. Arguing for the respondent, Robert H. Thomas. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes.
Okay, and we're sorry for the bit of a delay in getting started this morning, but we're very much looking forward to your arguments. Ms. Martin, you are reserving 15 minutes for rebuttal, is that correct? So we'll have a warning light that comes on with 15 minutes to go, and Mr. Thomas, 5-minute warning, so you'll get the light with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Very well. Ms. Martin, please proceed.
Good morning. Laurie Martin on behalf of the County of Hawaii and Christopher Ewan. The Intermediate Court of Appeals entered judgment on counts 1 and 2 in favor of Mr. Calvert. Both of those counts argue the subdivision is invalid because 7 lots exist. However, it's undisputed that the subdivision consists of only 6 lots. A sworn declaration was submitted along with the motion for summary judgment, and it was undisputed. In addition, plaintiff acknowledges in their reply brief and their footnote 8 indicating that only 6 lots exist because the 7th lot was consolidated.
But it was consolidated after the time of the application, correct? And after the approval of the application, isn't that right?
That's correct. There was another application submitted in 2006.
Okay, but the initial application that was approved and that was the basis for moving forward with the subdivision, at least from apparently the point of view of Mr. Pruglo, who began selling some or transferring some of the lots, at that time, that 7th lot still remained separate and had not been consolidated.
Initially, correct? That's correct, that there was 7 lots.
Okay, so how is it that the fact that the lot is somehow subsequently consolidated with another piece of property affects the question of whether the director had the authority to do what he did in approving the subdivision back in 2005 based on the conclusion that there were 6 lots consistent with the prior determination or representation by Ms. Goldstein?
Well, whether he actually had the authority to issue 7 in a lot of ways is moot because we know now there's only 6 and that there was a new application which granted 6. So looking at hindsight, did he have authority to grant 6 or have the authority to grant 7? It doesn't really matter because right now we know there's 6. The new application had 6. 6 is what's in existence now. It's not proper to invalidate the 6-lot subdivision now based upon something that happened in the past and got corrected.
Is that a way for people to avoid or subvert the purposes of the ordinances or statutes by post hoc manipulating things so that it would comply after the fact?
I don't think it's manipulation or trying to avoid the statute.
I know they did in this case, maybe, but wouldn't that be a logical?
I mean, it's possible, but the point is that those kinds of corrections should be encouraged. That if somebody thinks it's an error, or even if a neighbor disputes something, those kinds of corrections should be encouraged.
But that may be correct from policy. That may be excellent policy. But if the regulation isn't written that way, does that make it void? And if it is void, I think I'd like to ask you that as well. If it's void, what would be your interpretation of that decision?
If it's void, there would be a large issue with that because now all of those lot owners, Mr. Pruglo included, all of his property rights are gone. So they paid money to buy a lot in fee simple to have that exclusive right of possession for that area, and now they don't have that.
Why was there an objection to the inclusion of those other property owners?
From the county?
Yes.
From the county because the statute of limitations had already run. So it was futile at that point. I mean, we're talking about an approval that happened in 2005. Now that's 9 years ago. He filed the lawsuit in 2007, 7 years ago. Mr. Kalberg and his attorney, if they were really concerned with the subdivision and wanted to prevent it, they had that obligation, and there are certainly legal remedies available to them. They could have filed and immediately sought to have an injunction to stop any further sales or building permits, but they didn't do that. They could have brought in those owners and made them parties. but they didn't. Then they admit that that was a strategic decision. But the, so the county's left with, we believe the subdivision's valid. These lot owners are coming in for approvals. We have an obligation to issue those unless there's something that we believe is inappropriate. But the burden is on Mr. Kelbert. He's the one seeking the legal relief. He needs to set up his lawsuit and take those actions. No one can do that for him.
I thought the argument that you folks made down below, and maybe you did raise the statute of limitations, I thought it was more based on the additional costs, expenses, and delays.
I think that was part of it, but statute of limitations, I believe, was raised.
But isn't the statute of limitations a personal defense, and how do you know that the third parties will even assert it?
I think clearly the statute of limitations ran as far as Mr. Kelbert.
How do you know they'll even assert it? You don't even know that they're going to assert the statute of limitations. You're assuming they are, but how do you know that?
If the statute of limitations was not asserted at this point, 9 years after, that would be legal malpractice. Yeah, I am speculating that it's going to be raised.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, you're assuming it would be raised when, first of all, as the Chief Justice said, it's a personal right. But suppose they feared that if it was actually, because there's several defendants potentially, maybe they want to be involved because they believe if they stay involved, they may be able to prevent the court from ruling it void. They may want to participate. You're making a pretty big assumption, I think.
I think that it's a reasonable assumption. Somebody is suing, wanting to take away your property rights to say that that lot that you just bought does not exist. Yeah, I want to fight against that. But that doesn't mean I want to be a party to that lawsuit. You have meet your burden of proof. Bring me in legally. I may have certain rights as far as insurance, defense. But bring me in legally the way you're supposed to. There's a clear procedure for it. And if that comes to it, then I'll defend myself.
You don't know that they're going to assert the statute of limitations, and that's really not the question under 19A. The question under 19A is whether they're joinable or not. And no one is, as I understand it, arguing that these third parties were beyond the process of the court.
You raise a good point, and I understand what you're saying. What's interesting is the court didn't say you can't bring them in, right? We were arguing, no, the statute of limitations ran, it's too late. But the court said to Mr. Kelberg, yes, go ahead and bring them in. Go ahead and amend your complaint. And Mr. Kelberg didn't. He refused to do it.
Couldn't you have filed a motion to dismiss for their refusal?
Perhaps.
I mean, I think there's inherent authority, at least, and there's case law that says if a party refuses to join a party when there's been, especially when they've been found to be indispensable, the court can actually dismiss it even with prejudice.
I agree that perhaps we could have filed a motion to dismiss, but I believe that raising it is the same effect, that we are still raising it and saying it still precludes that remedy that Mr. Kelberg seeks, which is to invalidate the subdivision. It's inherently wrong and unfair to invalidate somebody's property rights when they're not parties to it. If he was just seeking damages, it could be a different issue. That's all I have, unless you have further questions.
If you wish to keep your remaining time for rebuttal, we'll hear from Mr. Thomas
at
this point. Thank you.
Before I begin, Your Honor, if you would indulge me a minute or two to get some things set up, I think it would help the court understand, because we're talking about various parcels and whatnot, just to get a visual idea. And
my understanding is that the counsel for the county is aware of this. And
oh, yes, these are both on the record.
Yep.
So.
Okay. Although what we're going to find is, yeah, that's going to have to move, or it'll block our. Okay, we're all good. Judge Garibaldi, can see.
Okay.
Can you see?
And may it please the court, Chief Justice, Director Wall, and may it please the court. Because the procedures in the circuit court were somewhat unusual, we've always tried to view this case, both times we've been before the court, from a practical and pragmatic standpoint. And there's really two major flaws in the county's argument. First, legally, I think the error in the subdivision that was admitted to by the planning director couldn't be corrected by consolidating parcel two, or what we call parcel two, but is really number four on both of these maps, that separate non-contiguous parcel, with a third party after the fact. That's not a correction because the illegality was from the inception of the application or from the inception of the approval of the application. And the problem of six lots north of Mr. Kelberg on parcel one, Mr. Kelberg is the big blank space down below. Underneath the three on the map on the left is Mr. Kelberg.
This is exhibit one you're talking about.
This is the exhibit, yes. There was six lots on parcel one, the big parcel, and it hasn't, in fact, not only in law was it not correctable by law under the regulations, as Justice Pollack pointed out, but in fact, the problem hasn't been rectified by essentially trying to wave a wand over the separate non-contiguous parcel two and making it disappear. Kelberg still has six lots north of him on the day that the application was wrongly granted on parcel one when he should have only five at the max. So in other words, they couldn't and didn't rectify the error in the illegally approved subdivision, and the case, and I'm finally hearing what I think is the argument that they're saying instead of rectification, it's really a question of mootness. And it wasn't briefed by the parties because the case wasn't, or at least the argument wasn't pitched as one of mootness. But I think that this court's, now that it has, this court's decision in Gu against Arakawa is quite informative because in that case, back in February, this court held that when a case became moot on appeal through one way or the other, I believe in that case it was the Maui County Council adopted an ordinance that gave the plaintiffs essentially the relief they were granted for. What happens when a case becomes moot on appeal? And I think this is what the ICA might have been looking at when it vacated both summary judgments entered by the circuit court on count one and two, which is the declaratory question of law that the court had ruled upon. And then second, it vacated and remanded with respect to the injunction, which is count five, and then count six, which is the damage question, and said, go back, because all of these issues that we're talking about with respect to statute of limitations, with respect to joinder, and all of the factors that Rule 19A and B require the court to walk through before it reaches the drastic remedy of dismissal, they're not apparently in the record because the court below didn't make those findings. So the ICA, I think, correctly recognized that there was a problem in granting the relief that the county wanted and said, go back and figure it out. We made this ruling of law. That's perfectly acceptable.
Didn't the ICA enter summary judgment or purport to enter summary judgment in your client's favor on counts one and two?
That's correct. Yes, Your Honor.
And had your client even moved for summary judgment?
Down below he had, yes.
On those counts?
On those counts, yes.
More than once. At the same time that the county did or earlier in the case?
Again, why I characterize this case as somewhat unusual, because we did not have a series of comprehensive motions. This was not a textbook case procedurally, but it was done in almost a piecemeal, peel-the-onion fashion with a lot of motions flying back and forth, repeat motions, the court on its own taking a ruling with respect to the first ruling the court, one of the first rulings the circuit court made, in fact, was on this indispensable party issue and ruled that the third parties, the absentees, are not indispensable as to all claims. And that was in the beginning. We operated for 2 years under that assumption in the circuit court before the circuit court said, well, now that I look at
but
it.
But aren't they indispensable as to whether or not the lots are actually valid and the transfers to them were therefore valid?
I don't think so. At least it's not, at least not with respect to count one and two the way it was framed, Your Honor, because it was framed purely as a legal question. And on that, I'm not sure what their presence would or wouldn't add to the question. You know, the facts were admitted. Both sides said this is appropriate for summary judgment.
Well, what relief does your client want?
He'd like an injunction to stop it or to he'd like a declaration, first of all.
Of course.
The declaration
is that all? Is that all he wants?
Void ab initio.
He wants something else, too, right?
Yes. Okay. And at this point, he has asked for and hasn't gotten past the stage of count five, which is the injunction. To order the director under the regulations to order the subdivider to correct the errors as the regulation allows. And I'm pointing the court to, let me get the citation for you.
And what would that mean for the lot owners that already purchased?
We're not sure. And that's the point of why, I think, why the ICA remanded, because there's no record to figure out what that means at this stage. And so the ICA said, go back to the circuit court, see if you can fashion a remedy either with or without the parties.
Did it say with or without the parties?
No,
it did not.
Unfortunately, the ICA's SDO did not have the language. But if you look at the last page of the ICA's opinion and its final footnote, it says we vacate with respect to count five, and we remand it for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. And we're not telling you, circuit court, what to do and what remedy, if any, Mr. Kelber might be entitled to.
Mr. Thomas, at some point in time, you moved to amend the complaint.
That's right.
And then you actually attached a proposed amended complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But you elected not to file it.
Let me explain why.
And now you're saying you don't know what the remedy would be because the record wasn't developed. Isn't the fact that the record wasn't developed because you didn't file your amended complaint?
Well, the record's not available because the facts were not developed. We didn't get past summary judgment, the final summary judgment in favor of the county that ended up being us here the first time before the ICA and then this court and where we are now. So we didn't get there because we actually didn't get, in essence, past the pleading stage in the circuit court. So the reason the record's undeveloped, what I'm getting at is the issues with respect to joinder, which this court has noted, of course, many times in the past, are fact-driven issues. We don't know. Could they be joined? As Chief Justice Recklinghall pointed out, would they assert, is it so obvious that they would assert their personal right to the statute of limitations defense? Again, it's somewhat of a fact-driven exercise, and things like that. So
so you can refuse to join and follow through because it's speculative on what's going to happen?
First of all, I'd like to explain, I think, the timing. And again, it goes back to sort of the unusual procedural postures or the process that this case was. There was literally about 3 months between the time the court allowed amendment over objection, over the county's objection in March of 2010, and then the time that the court actually granted the county's motion for summary judgment that got rid of the entire case and that essentially made any efforts to amend the complaint moot at that point. So what happened was early on the court, as I mentioned, held that in one of its first orders that Mr. Kelber could proceed in his entire case and that anybody else who was not before the court was not indispensable, and we operated that for under 2 years. And only later, in September of 2010, did the court flip on the remedy and say, wait a minute, with respect to count five only. And I would like to emphasize that in the court's order dated October 15th, 2010, on page 2, the court said, furthermore, the court finds that the owners of the subdivided property are indispensable parties to this action as required under Rule 19 of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure. And this is in a form of order drafted by the Corporation Counsel's Office. And then the judge in his own handwriting writes in, as to the relief sought in count five. So he leaves alone the ruling with respect to indispensability that he made 2 years earlier on count one. And he says, it's only as to remedy that I'm finding that they're indispensable. Okay. So Kelberg then sought leave to amend, to add, over which the county objected. And then a week later, Judge Hara self-disqualified himself, or self-declared he was disqualified. And we end up, I think, we've gone through 3 out of the 4 judges in the Third Circuit at this point. And it ends up before Judge Ibarra. The court then entered an order allowing amendment 3 months later in March of 2010. And Kelberg at that point believed that Judge Hara's orders that he entered during the time he was factually disqualified weren't valid, and especially those that might contradict his earlier ruling with respect to indispensability. So Kelberg asked Judge Ibarra for a supplemental injunctive relief, and it was essentially a recon, a motion for recon on the Judge Hara's denial of the motion for summary judgment on count five. Mr. Kelberg also asked Judge Hara to vacate Judge Hara's rulings that were made during the period which Judge Hara had disclosed that he was, or at least the facts were in operation, that Judge Hara might have been disqualified. Ultimately, Judge Ibarra denies both of those and denies Kelberg's supplemental motion regarding count five in June of 2010. And so right at the same time, the county had moved for summary judgment with respect to all claims. And the court, Judge Ibarra, at that point on June 16th, 2010, granted the county summary judgment and got rid of the entire case. So
why is it that he didn't file? I'm sorry. You're saying it's because he believed that the order allowing him to file was void?
No, I'm sorry. The order,
Hara's order granting him leave to amend was void?
No, in fact, it was Judge Ibarra who had granted, that was the first motion that he granted when he got assigned to the case post-Judge Hara disqualification.
Was the motion for leave to amend?
The motion for leave to amend that had been filed as a consequence of Judge Hara denying the motion, Kelberg's motion for summary judgment on count five. He said, I can't grant Kelberg summary judgment on count five. And that's the order I was mentioning here where he handwrites in, well, because of with respect to count five, you've got some indispensable parties.
So come back to the question, why did he not file? And is his failure to file relevant to our inquiry at this point?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And why he didn't file is it was, I wish I could tell you exactly why he didn't. I wasn't the lawyer at that stage of the case. But it was a matter of about 3 months in which these other motions were flying back and forth, and he thought he would address the predicate question first, which is, was Judge Hara's order that I'm mentioning here, saying he was indispensable, was that void because Judge Hara was disqualified at the time he made it? He wanted a clarification on that ruling before he took the plunge and filed the motion or filed the amended complaint that he had been allowed to file.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay, because I'm reading the reply brief now, and that was filed on behalf of Mr. Kelberg, and it doesn't appear, this is a reply brief in the ICA, it doesn't appear to be arguing that this distraction of having the other matter was the reason. It talks a lot about, it says it was a strategic decision not to name the lot owners, they were not necessary parties. Unvarnished truth is lot owners are nothing more than speculators and opportunists. Their financial interests can be properly adjudged in a separate enforcement proceeding. So a lot of reasons. One argument is made the court was obligated to order them joined. So a lot of reasons other than.
And I think they're all valid, but I think the threat, Mr. Kelberg, I believe, was proceeding pro se at that point. So maybe the rhetoric was a little bit higher than it should be.
In the reply brief or in the trial?
In his reply brief.
I think he was had Mr. Whitaker.
Had Mr. Whitaker joined the case by then?
Rejoined
the case, yes. Forgive me. But I think the thread is the same thread, that he believed that Judge Hara's final act, his final order saying that they were indispensable, was void because Judge Hara was disqualified at the time that he made that order. And so he filed a motion with Judge Ibarra both to reconsider Judge Hara's order, holding them indispensable, and he filed a motion to vacate that order, both of which were ultimately denied just before Judge Ibarra granted the county summary judgment and wiped the case out. I mean, 3 months in litigation time, as we're all aware, it sounds like a lot of time, but it's not a whole lot of time in litigation lawyer time. So all of this was going on. He was attempting to see if Judge Hara's disqualification had any impact on the orders that Judge Hara had made that he thought weren't right. The critical one being, of course, the order denying him relief on count five because the owners of the subdivided property are indispensable parties only with respect to that.
Would you agree that the third parties are Rule 19A parties, that there are necessary parties, I guess, is used sometimes in our cases?
It would be very hard, I think, for me to stand before you today and tell you that the owner of a subdivided property, the applicant and the owner of the subdivided property, doesn't have any interest whatsoever even in a legal ruling that's between Kelberg and the county. Kelberg's problems was with the count, with the, how the county approved it. He didn't have, in a sense, any real problems directly with the owner of the subdivision. I mean, it was a problem in the approval and the exemption process when the 6 versus 7 issue.
So I'm going to take that as a yes.
That's as close as a yes that I can make. But again, I don't think it necessarily addresses a yes on that. Doesn't necessarily get us past to where the county wants us to be with or the court to be with respect to count one.
But if the answer to that is yes, how can the ICA grant summary judgment on counts 1 and 2 when those folks aren't even there to protect their interests?
It's because you think about adding them there. What could they have said with respect to the summary judgment, the partial summary judgment that the ICA granted? And again, I think this is a function of the way the complaint was set up, calling declaratory judgment a claim for relief or a cause of action or a count, an injunction account, when in the parlance I tend to use, those are remedies as opposed to your claim for relief. The claim for relief is breach of statute or breach of ordinance, violation of ordinance. And then the relief would have been a declaratory judgment or an injunction. But I think as this court noted in the first Kelberg opinion, you know, inartful pleadings shouldn't get in the way of making the right decision in this case. So essentially, the ICA has entered partial summary judgment on pure legal issues because the facts aren't undisputed. So you add those parties, they're not going to come in and say, well, actually, there were only 6 parcels at the time in 2005, at the time of
But wait a minute, does the application of indispensable party, is it determined based upon the fact whether the court is going to be determining issues of law or the facts are undisputed? I mean, Rule 19 doesn't say, well, you don't have to join people if what the court is going to be considering, the facts are undisputed.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, but you look at the Marvin against Pfluger case that this court issued not terribly long ago, and the analysis you go through, the court said it was a case by case, and you take the law that's applicable to the case and you apply it to the situation, and then you see. The court said it's a very practical, pragmatic determination. There's no sort of hard and fast rules for who's a necessary party.
So you're basically conceding that even if your client prevails, that their lots remain intact and the transfers to them, nothing, their rights are not going to be affected at all.
Yes, that is exactly what the ICA ordered, because it said this is the rule, this is the law, that violation of ordinance, this application for subdivision was not exempt in 2005 when the director granted it by mistake. That's mm-hmm. all the ICA said with respect to count one. With respect to count five, there might be indispensable parties. The ICA said we remand with respect to count five for injunction, we remand with respect to count six for damages. Trial court, figure that out. And I assume at that point when it goes back.
So they would have no say as to the validity of the subdivision. They have no interest in that, arguing for that. It doesn't affect them at all.
Well, I think, the fact is they weren't parties when the ruling was made. They're actually, I think they're technically not bound by the decision. Could they join and then ask for a recon on that basis? I don't know. But that's one of the things I think the trial courts are good at figuring out, because it can start gathering the facts with respect to joinder. Are these necessary parties? Do they have an interest? Who exactly are these people? It can gather the facts with respect to the statute of limitations. Are they going to, we'll find out whether they assert it or not.
Wait, I didn't follow something you said, that they aren't bound by it? What did you mean by that?
Well, parties not before the court, I mean, it's generally a rule of you know, black letter law that a party not before the court is not bound by a court's decisions.
Isn't that exactly what Rule 19 is all about? And that's the point, which is that they should have been joined long ago, it would seem.
Well, and I think this takes me back to the Marvin case, where the court recognized, again, pragmatically, that who we think should be before the court is a different question of can you proceed given that they're not before the court, what can you do? And that, I think, is the situation we find ourselves in. I my concession was, should they have been before the court in the perfect world? Well, of course, we all hope that any time there's disputes between that may impact more than a few people, everybody comes in. The Goo case, I think there was some procedure in that case, because I do believe indispensable parties was raised in that, and the circuit court, because of the numerosity, the parties kind of did a semi-class action type of thing, sent out notices, do you want to join, do you want to intervene? And so,
Mr. Thomas,
yes.
In the Marvin case, that is what happened also. They asked the particular person, do you want to be a part of this? And the party said, no, I don't want to be a part of it. And then it wasn't raised till much, much later.
Yes.
In this particular case, did the parties have an opportunity to decline to be a part of it?
As a matter of fact, they did. Now, not a formal, they did not do what the circuit court did in the Goo case, which was actually order one party or the other, I can't recall which, to send out notices to potential owners within the subdivision that was being affected and say, there's notice of a claim being filed, essentially the same thing you get when you get the class action notice. Do you want to participate, yes or no? If you do, you know, show up and or bring your own lawyer. That was not done in this case, but I think it's quite clear from the record here that Mr. Pruglo knew about this right away. Every owner was told, Kelberg was shouting this from the ceilings. He was telling everybody he could, trying to get some relief from somewhere, and I think it's set out in quite an accurate fashion in this court's Kelberg 1 opinion, the recitation of the facts. Kelberg not went through this sort of administrative odyssey with respect to the county, but at the same time, he was going and talking to everybody he could, sending letters, talking to them, running into them in the store, telling them, look,
shouldn't the ICA, we sent the case back to the ICA with direction to consider all of the issues. The ICA, we obviously have an issue which sort of colors the entire case or impacts the entire case, which is a failure to join these other parties. Should not the ICA have addressed that issue explicitly? And if so, is there any possible conclusion, or how would you support a conclusion other than that they should be ordered joined at this point?
Well, two things. I don't think you necessarily reach that result. Now, I can't tell you. I can't stand before you today and tell you why the ICA wrote its opinion the way it wrote it. I wish I did, but I can't tell you why. We, in our cert papers, suggested there were reasons why and why the ICA was under no obligation to go through every seriatim, through every argument made, and reject every argument made expressly.
Okay, well,
the argument basically says that one can assume that if an issue isn't addressed, that they found it meritless. So, in other words, an appellate court would just have to assume that every time it wasn't considered, that the analyzing court looked at it and found it without merit. It's a really odd analysis from it.
Well, I'm not so sure that I would agree with you. So I would beg to differ with you that, having never sat in your honor seats, I don't understand completely. I can't say I can stand here as an advocate and understand the judicial process of what makes it into an opinion and what doesn't, particularly at an extremely busy Court of Appeals, mandatory court, as hears cases as of right, dealing with 8 points of appeal in this particular case. Not the briefs were somewhat dense, let me put it that way. I'm afraid I can't offer more than what I found in the case law that I cited.
Let me help you out. Your argument is they implicitly denied it, or they implicitly rejected the argument that they were parties who should have been joined. Now, why is it that that's not an error from your perspective? Why, at a minimum, should they not be joined or ordered joined as Rule 19A necessary parties?
Because I think it's not the ICA's job to make that ruling, and the ICA did the same result. It sent it back down to the trial court. The circuit court, if it goes through the analysis of Rule 19A, Rule 19B, like it should have.
But why would it do that? If the ICA implicitly said that argument's without merit, what's the circuit court supposed to do when it gets the case? I understand one view of the world is, yeah, it's all open for them to do, but certainly another view of the world from that court's perspective might be the ICA had this, like you say, they implicitly must have rejected it. I'm moving on. That's not an issue for me.
Maybe, forgive me, maybe I wasn't clear enough. I'm not suggesting that the only conclusion to be reached from the ICA's silence is that the ICA ruled for us on the merits of Rule 19A and B. The remedy it imposed was vacate the summary judgment, where the court said, the court finds that the owners of the subdivided property are indispensable parties to this action as required under Rule 19 of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure as to the relief sought in Count 5. And so the ICA, all it did was vacate that order. It did not say, oh, they aren't indispensable parties, and it said go back to the circuit court and see what remedies, if any. And I think that those two words are very critical, if any. And we take, I think I believe the ICA in the footnote even said, we're not telling the court or the circuit court if there is any remedies, but go figure it out. Walk through, you know, and so we're, Chief Justice, I don't mean to say that they said these aren't indispensable parties. They simply vacated it. And they might not be.
So they were silent on that issue despite
they were silent on that issue.
Our direction to address these other issues in the case.
Yes.
Now, why doesn't it make sense from your client's perspective, or perhaps it does, to direct that the trial court order the joinder of these other parties at this stage?
I'm sorry.
In your view, would it be appropriate or inappropriate for this court to direct the trial court to enter an order directing your client to join these other parties at this point?
I think it's too soon. The Rule 19A and Rule 19B together, and this court's decisions with respect to that rule, say it's a very fact-intensive case-by-case inquiry. We don't know from the court of or the orders, the various orders entered over the years by the court below, never walked through that analysis, and so I think it's premature.
You think that a declaration that the subdivision under which these people took the property that created the lots from that were conveyed to them, a declaration along those lines, does not affect their interests?
Well, not until you get to the remedy. I mean, a declaration
really?
Of law.
Really? So this ruling itself does not affect their, it's not a cloud on their title?
Well, and I think that's why in response to the Chief Justice's question, I said it would be very hard for me to stand here before you today and say that they have absolutely no interest in the case. But and so I think the crux, and you know, so Rule 19A is not going to be, I suspect, a very large hurdle on remand one way or the other. I think it will be Rule 19B, and that's where the rubber meets the road with respect to the remedy they want, because the remedy that the county suggests.
Well, these people can be joined.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
These people can be joined.
I think they could be joined.
Of course.
Yes. Yes. And under Rule 19A, end of story at that point, right? If they're determined necessary and they should be there and they can be joined, then we go and we try to join them. If we can't join them, then before the court finds that they're indispensable, has to go through all those factors that they set out of balancing the equities.
And on this record, what is your position with regard to whether your client should somehow be deemed at fault for not having joined them?
That he shouldn't.
Why not?
First of all, he was entitled to rely on the circuit court's initial order that stayed in place undisturbed for 2 years.
But once the circuit court said, no, these people are indispensable parties.
He moved. I'm sorry.
You know,
let me finish.
Why not at that point? Why not at that point?
He moved as quickly as he could in what I would characterize as litigation time. 3 months is nothing. And then meanwhile, the events of the other motions that were flying back and forth caught up to him. And the court dismissed the case. So end of story. Had the court not dismissed the case, he would have joined them.
The court granted summary judgment. I didn't dismiss.
I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor. Forgive me that I'm using the wrong parlance. But yes, the court granted summary judgment on all counts. I'm somewhat colorblind, Chief.
No,
Justice.
You can keep. Continue answering our question.
No, that's unless Justice Bollock. Unless that didn't answer your question.
No, it didn't.
Okay. Thank you. I believe my time's up, Chief Justice.
Just if you'd like to just wrap up briefly for. A moment or two, or a minute or two. How's that?
Unless the court has any further questions, we ask this court affirm. We think that the ICA put in place a very practical, pragmatic, legally correct, and totally defensible opinion and sent it back down to circuit court for these issues.
Let me just come back to one question. I'm sorry, your client does or does not want the subdivision undone as opposed to just wanting damages?
Yeah, he wants an injunction to undo it.
Okay.
Or to do it right, maybe I should say it that way, to have it done right. Because remember, this was only exempt because they came in and said, as the map on the right shows, there were six pre-existing lots, including the non-contiguous, what's labeled as number four. When the application came in, which is this map on the left, there turned out to be, it applied for six lots, including, or not including, the one down below, which is labeled as four prime. So there wasn't a mistake. Nobody overlooked four, as I think there's been a misapprehension that they keep saying everybody forgot about four. Well, the fact of the matter is they didn't forget about four. They knew it was there, and they subdivided the larger, what we call lot one.
I think we understand the arguments on the merits.
Yes.
The question is, you want the trial court to order that it should go the way your client thought it should go, which is only to approve six, correct?
That's correct, and the way we think that the law is very clear about. So, yes, Your Honor.
Which would require invalidating the approval that was made back in 2005
yes.
by the planning director, and then some new process begun at that point to
perhaps,
or a new application made at that point, or we'd be back to zero at that.
We'd be back to 2005 at least.
So they'd have to remove the homes.
Well, we don't know. I mean, that's what I think the trial court will take a look at. It may say, you know, it's too late to do this. We're going to have to go for damages instead because damages will be the remedy because it's too late to do anything. Maybe they're vested, maybe they're not. As the court's aware, the vested rights analysis is much more complex than a one-sentence sort of legal conclusion in a declaration filed by a planner. We've had tons of cases over the years from this court on the question of what's a vested right and what's a remedy for a vested right. But in this case, Mr. Kelberg in count five sought an injunction, and then I won't say alternatively, but in addition in count six seeks damages. So maybe the court will say, well, we can't add these people. It's too unfair. We don't know. Go for damages instead. And that's the type of thing that circuit courts are uniquely qualified to do, and we shouldn't be doing this on this record before this court.
So Mr. Kelberg's position would be you should undo it and take me back to 2005, but what you're acknowledging is the court may or may not agree with that argument, and if it doesn't, may just say, sorry, I can't do that. You only get damages.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Martin.
Attorney argued that.
Could we turn the light off, please? I'm sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Kelberg's attorney argued that they knew they had to add parties, and that's why they filed the motion for leave to amend the complaint. They got that permission, but things just happened too quickly. However, if you look at the record on appeal at 14, which sets out all of the documents which were filed, you can see that they had ample time to go ahead and file that amended complaint if they wanted to do that. And as the Chief Justice pointed out, they argued in their reply brief that they had made a strategic decision not to add those parties. It was a deliberate decision. The circuit court had already ruled you need to add these parties if you want this injunctive relief. They are indispensable. That's why they filed that motion to leave. Counsel, Mr. Whitaker.
Mr. Thomas said that ruling was only pertaining to one count.
The injunctive relief. I believe that that's accurate. But they knew that in order to get the relief they wanted, they had to add these parties. And in fact, Mr. Whitaker stated in his declaration on the record of appeal on page 912, paragraph 3, because of the court's order, it appears plaintiff must add the parties identified if he hopes to get any appropriate relief, including injunctions. So they were well aware, but they did not want to do that for strategic reasons. So it's already been ordered. There's no benefit for this court to order it now. It was already ordered. The circuit court already ordered it. They were going to go through it and then decided, no, we don't want to.
Was it actually ordered, or in what sense was it ordered?
When the court denied relief and said they are indispensable parties, I can't give you that relief. And they acknowledged that. They filed them. They used that to get leave to amend their complaint, but then they failed to do it.
Did the attached, there was an attached amended complaint?
Yes, it was.
Did it limit the additional parties to only one count?
I don't believe so. I can check that. I don't have that tabbed. But I believe it was for all the counts. Mr. Kelberg's attorney argued that they want injunctive relief to go and correct this error. That's part of the relief that they're seeking. But the error has already been corrected. We already know that there's six laws. There's no injunctive relief to fix it. It's already been fixed. There's no other facts that need to be developed. We filed a motion for summary judgment. They filed a couple of motions for summary judgment. The facts which the parties thought were necessary were in there. There's nothing else to be done at the circuit court level.
Well, I want to come back to, if I could, the question of what the court, whether the court sufficiently ordered joinder of these other parties. You know, Rule 19 says if the person, talking about 19A, if the person, a Rule 19A type person, necessary party, I'll refer to him just for shorthand, has not been so joined, the court shall order that the person be made a party. Now, in this instance, did the court direct them to order to make them a party?
No, I don't believe he used those words. He denied the relief and saying that it would be unjust and that they were indispensable parties.
And the court did grant the motion to amend.
I'm sorry?
The court did grant the motion to amend.
That's correct.
Well, what do you make of the language of Rule 19, where it seems mandatory for a court shall to order the party to be made, the person to be made a party?
I think that generally it's going to be the plaintiff that, or somebody that's moving to get that kind of order, to order those individuals to be parties. In this particular case, it's clear the county continually raised this issue of these parties. The court said he was not going to provide the relief or order the relief that the plaintiff wanted unless those people were added and that they were indispensable parties. And so although the words may be a little bit different and not follow the rule, the intent was clear, the knowledge of the parties were clear on what had to happen if you were going to get that kind of relief.
But isn't this, in a sense, then an illustration of why the rule perhaps requires that level of specificity? Because you get into ambiguous situations where, for example, in this case, Mr. Kelberg can say, well, as he did in his reply brief, although the court had indicated that I am the master of my complaint and I didn't believe I was required to join these other folks because my beef was with the county. Isn't that kind of the point of the rule, to require clarity that the court will say you shall join these people, or we're going to be moving on to rule, I guess, moving on to 19B, or considering some other alternative?
That may be the intent of the rule, but I think that process certainly took place in this case, because when the plaintiff came in and asked for that specific relief and the court said, no, I can't grant you that specific relief unless you add these parties as indispensable parties. So the effect is the same. He's clearly on notice. He stated it repeatedly. Even in his reply brief, he admits that they are necessary parties, but he still doesn't add it.
But the rule doesn't say you don't get the relief you want unless you join the parties. The rule just says if a person has not been so joined, the court shall order the person to be made a party. It's not conditional.
I think just as an attorney's obligation to fashion their complaint and the legal position, if you want certain relief, there are steps that you need to take. It's not the court's job to decide, well, you need these particular people or that one might not be necessary. It's up to the attorney and the party to add those parties and fashion their legal pleadings and move forward in such a way. If I expect to get relief, if I expect to set aside the subdivision, I'm going to add anybody who has an interest. Similar to a quiet title or any other action that you're trying to have a binding order, you're going to add those parties. these people have an interest in their property. It's difficult to imagine a greater interest than that. It's not the court's obligation to make sure you fashion your pleadings a certain way.
Would you agree with Ms. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, well, but as Justice Nakayama points out, the rule says if the person has not been so joined, the court shall order the person to be a party. It's not as flexible and as up to the attorney. It appears that the rule mandates it.
I agree that that language does say shall, and I still go back to Judge Hara's ruling where he said, I can't grant this relief unless you add them. So clearly the intent is there to make it mandatory that if you want this relief, you need to add them. But he, on another side, he's not deciding, well, are you going to go forward with this injunctive relief? Are you going to drop that claim? Are you only going to go with the money damages? It's just this other issue. In a lot of ways, how would a court ever know all of the indispensable parties? Unless somebody raises the issue and starts to identify. Even in this case, where it was undisputed and there were lot owners and some of them were identified, I'm not sure all of the lot owners were identified. I'm not sure that all of the property owners were
identified. Well, that's pretty easy to determine, though.
It is, but is that the obligation of the court to do it? Or is it the obligation of the party, the person who's seeking the relief that's going to affect those lot owners? Or is it the court's obligation to say, well, did we get all of the lot owners? I said lot owners, but wait, there's somebody leasing the property.
Actually, Rule 19C says that a pleading asserting a claim for relief shall state the names, if known to the pleader, of any persons as described in subdivisions A1 to 2 hereof who are not joined and the reasons why they are not joined. So that, at least it could be argued, appears to anticipate that there'll be some notice given to the court, which at that point needs to make a judgment and then shall take particular action in ordering joinder. So it does appear, at least reading that portion of the rule, does appear that there is some obligation on the court to act.
On Rule 19. But I believe Judge Hara did ask. You know, he was asking about whether there were lot owners and whether they were parties, and that's exactly why he denied the relief. If they added the parties, which they said that they were going to do, then he would have reevaluated that.
Would you agree with Mr. Thomas's assertion that the initial ruling by Judge Hara back in, I think it was 07, where he seemed to indicate that he thought there could be relief fashioned that wouldn't sufficiently implicate the interests of these third parties, that he would not conclude they were indispensable? Would you agree at that point there was no obligation on Mr. Kelberg to join these parties? It wasn't until the ruling that we've been talking about here in 2009, I believe, when the court said, I'm not going to give you an injunction, here's why. So at what point was that duty triggered? Would you agree with him there was no duty for Mr. Kelberg to join those folks until 09, based on Judge Hara's initial ruling?
No, I don't. I believe that the instant he filed the complaint, he had an obligation to add them because of the relief which he was seeking in the complaint.
Or at least identify them and say why he wasn't included.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, his complaint is seeking injunctive relief and trying to have this subdivision declared void. So clearly those parties, he should have named those parties at that point. And I know Judge Hara initially was hoping the Board of Appeals would resolve some of the issues, and he had remanded it. And for that purpose, the lot owners might not have been indispensable parties. But clearly, the claims and the complaint itself, if the plaintiff's pursuing those claims, the lot owners are indispensable parties.
And they would have been here if they had been joined even for that particular count. They had been here all through the appeal to the ICA, expressing their opinion as to how the ICA handle that and be here today, perhaps.
Perhaps they would be represented by joint. And perhaps the ICA wouldn't have ordered the subdivision invalid despite there being only six lots. You know, I was thinking.
They may have raised issues.
They could have raised
issues. Vested rights.
Exactly. And the county's interest, even though obviously the lot owners and the county's interest would be the same as far as upholding the subdivision, but our interests are very different because they are owners of property which the county does not have that perspective at all. So
their title insurers might have come in and provided defenses.
There could have been a number of defenses.
We might not be here.
That's true. It would clearly be unjust to permit the ICA's decision to stand where this subdivision has been declared invalid in these individual owners' lots. Basically would not exist. What they purchased years ago now does not exist. It would clearly be unjust.
So in your position would be that it's on the Rule 19 issue, what is the appropriate disposition with regard to that at this point?
In my opinion?
Send it back to the trial court, deal with it here. If so, is it a summary judgment issue? Is it a dismissal issue? What do you think?
I believe that this court should find that the plaintiff did not name all the parties for the relief that he sought, that he was on notice. The court told him that the relief he wanted was not going to be granted without those parties, that he proceeded to obtain leave to do that, and then, by their own admission, made a strategic decision not to do so. And by doing that, by saying, look, I am making a conscious decision, a strategic decision, for whatever reason, not to add them, they are giving up certain claims. They're giving up claims to declare the subdivision void. They're giving up injunctive relief claims. They might have monetary damages claims, but as far as trying to send it back and order it again, they have had 7 years to do this. The court has made it clear what they needed to do. The county kept raising this issue.
But you never moved to dismiss them.
We moved for summary judgment, and that was one of the issues. And actually, there were, I think, a couple of motions to dismiss based upon indispensable parties, but I think it was before they were granted leave.
And what about the argument that, is there anything in the record to support the argument that they just didn't have time, Mr. Kelber just didn't have time?
No, and this is what I was referring to, the Record on Appeal 14, where it has the computerized index of the pleadings. The order denying plaintiff's injunctive relief was on October 15, 2010. So they were on notice at that point regarding the need to add parties.
And when did they move to amend, to add?
Let me see.
And when was it order granting?
I believe the motion,
December 9th
of 2010, the motion was filed.
Was it March 2010, the order entered allowing amendment?
Yeah, March 3rd, 2010, the motion for leave was granted.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sounds like it's before the ruling.
Before
the motion.
Right, you said October 2010 was the order denying injunction.
Yeah.
In which the Judge Hara said
they're indispensable.
They're indispensable.
Yeah.
But in March, they had already gotten an order?
Oh, no, that's March 2011.
Okay.
That the order granting leave to amend, I see. And then it was a 3-month period before the summary judgment was granted, correct?
I think it was longer than that. I'm trying to find that. Okay, yeah, we filed the motion for summary judgment in April 2011.
Okay, so your position is that the clock really shouldn't be running from March or when the order was granted. You think the clock really was running from back in, well, October 15th, but actually they did file, Mr. Kelberg did file a lot. You had to have gotten approval to file a First Amendment complaint. So your position is that 3-month window between the granting of the motion for leave to amend and the granting of the summary judgment was sufficient time to move forward. Is that correct?
The 3-month time wasn't the order granting the motion for summary judgment. I think that was our motion for summary judgment.
I see.
Our motion for summary judgment was filed in April 2000.
I guess my question is a simple one. Is there anything to your knowledge in the record that indicated Mr. Kelberg said, Your Honor, I'm asking for you to delay ruling on the summary judgment because I simply haven't had time to file the amended complaint?
Definitely not. And had he followed through with his leave to amend and filed the amended complaint, that would have taken away the county's defense of indispensable parties. But they never did. And in fact, the judgment wasn't entered for quite some time. So any time during that period, they could have.
So your position is that these parties are indispensable with regard to the injunctive relief, and it would be with regard to the declaratory
exactly.
relief as well. But the damage claims might still be in the case.
Yeah, as far as the indispensable parties.
Okay. But how do they get to damages without at least a declaration?
Well, I guess as far as the county's concern, the subdivision is clearly legal at this point.
Right.
So they're not entitled to any damages.
Right, and they don't, but their entitlement to the damages would be based on a ruling in their favor, Mr.
Right.
Kelber's favor, as to the illegality of the subdivision.
Right. But
which
I
would affect
I
the interests of these lot owners.
That is true. That is concerning. But I think clearly, the ICA's opinion that the subdivision is illegal is unjust and certainly isn't fair to those property owners and needs to be reversed. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. The court will take this matter under advisement.